very good afternoon. With only 4 days to go to the referendum, you guys have got to start making up your mind. Is it going to be a no? Is it going to be a yes? Are you still one of those many people in the country? Actually, I would probably say the majority of people in the country who have no idea what's actually going on. And you're just confused by the whole thing. Durable relationships, women in the home, allegedly, although it doesn't say that anywhere in the Constitution. Are you confused about the whole thing? And also confused about the fact that we spoke earlier on to Desi Ellis from Sinn Féin, who said, yes, Sinn Féin will rerun it if it's a no vote. But I did ask Desi Ellis, would they be changing the wording if they were going to rerun it? And he wasn't really too sure about that. Although he did say the wording didn't go far enough, and he did say the wording was wrong. So you would expect the opposition then to oppose the government and say, this is not right. We need to have no vote on this until we get it right. But then again, you could be one of the yes voters. And I struggled today at the show, by the way, when I was asking our callers to call in and tell us whether they were voting yes or no. I struggled to get yes voters. And I mentioned that even some of my lefty friends, and I do have some lefty friends, by the way, and I call on them every now and again just to give the show some balance, they even struggled as to whether they were going to vote yes or no. But what are you going to do? What are you going to vote? Are you going to vote yes or no? And it's one of those big stumbling blocks, this durable relationship thing. This seems to be really getting people. So what is a durable relationship? God only knows, but the minister seems to have an idea in his head, and he said the courts can decide eventually what a durable relationship is. Well, one man who also has a confusion about a durable relationship and discussing the upcoming referendum in March said the government can't clarify what a durable relationship is or means. It has decided to leave it to the courts to define. And that's Michael McNamara, TD, who joins me on the line. Michael, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Michael, this is probably one of the most complicated referendums in my 60 years, or certainly 30 years of broadcasting. Normally, referendums are quite clear and people have a very good understanding of what it is. For example, in the marriage equality referendum, can same-sex couples get married? The abortion referendum, you either agree with it or you don't. But this one, there's a little bit of mishmash and there's a bit of everything. And then there's confusion generally about some of the wording that's being used.
Yeah, no, I think part of that is because of the way the referendum is framed. I mean, there are two different questions being asked, and both of those questions contain two separate proposals. So you either vote for both proposals that are contained in the first referendum, or you vote for both referendums in the second one. And that's, I think, a bad idea. I mean, you keep things as simple as possible. The other thing is, I think the government haven't done a very good job of explaining what it is they're proposing to do, or even why they're proposing to do it. And the onus, of course, is on the government because they're proposing to change the constitution. Unlike other recent referenda, there was either a legal necessity to do it, like the Nice Treaty referendum or the Lisbon Treaty referendum, because the European Union decided it was changing its rules, and therefore Ireland, if it wanted to continue in the inner part of the European Union with the other member states, had to accept those changes or else not be part of what was the further integration that was being proposed. Or in the case of the gay marriage referendum and abortion referendum, there was a major sort of, I think, societal demand that those referenda be held. The confusion seems to me to be holding a referendum for the sake of it.
The confusion of the carers part is that we're not just changing something, we're completely removing something. And that's, for a lot of people, is a bit of a problematic. I mean, some people had even suggested that the wording should have been more encompassing. In other words, to change the word mother to parents or to mother and father or woman and man. But instead, we're just
removing... In the carers referendum, removing two articles. We're proposing to remove two articles of the Constitution, which are slightly different. The first one is Article 41.2.1, which states, in particular, the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. Now, that's an article. You might agree with it, you might agree with removing it, you might not agree with removing it, but it's an article that's proposed to be removed. But you can't vote on that alone. You have to vote also. If you want to remove that, you have to vote to remove the following article, which is, the state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. And not alone do you have to agree to removing that as well, but you have to agree with what the government are proposing to replace it with, which is broadly...
The state recognises the provision of care by members of a family to one another by reason of bonds that exist among them, and to give gives to society a support without which the common good cannot be achieved, and they shall strive, which is a problematic word for some people, to support such provisions. In other words, we're actually taking out two sections of the Constitution, replacing it with one, which for some people doesn't relate to the other two sections. And that's kind of problematic for some people, as much as we might want to update and modernise part of the Constitution. And the Constitution is a living document, of course, and we have to do that. I mean, that we have an obligation to do that because it obviously dates back to the 1930s. But in saying that, people believe that, could we not have had all of that? Could we not have just added a line into the Constitution that recognises carers? And could we not have been a little bit more defined? Because even carers now are not happy with the word strive. They're not happy with the idea that the government are pawning them off to their family members rather than the government taking a level of responsibility, because that's what it seems to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, many disability groups here in Clare, where I'm speaking to you from, and across the country, have taken issue with this, that they feel that the state is not acknowledging that it is a duty to all of its citizens to provide necessary care to all of its citizens, and instead it's making it the sole obligation of family members to provide care. So that's an important distinction. Then the other one is the idea that it shall strive. Now, to endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour. That's basically the state shall endeavour to ensure that mothers will not have to leave the home. Now, the former Chief Justice Susan Denham, who clearly chose to pursue a career herself, was very adamant in explaining this, that this is not, did not consign women to a life in the home. It did not consign mothers to be stay-at-home mothers. It merely said that if they wished to be stay-at-home mothers, that they could do so, but the Constitution did not consign mothers to that. One of the other problems is that it hasn't it has never gone beyond being mere words of support towards actually compelling the state to ensure that mothers didn't have to leave the home. My friend and I were discussing about the big societal changes between when we grew up and that you could support a family with one income. Father was a farmer, his worked in a factory, and they were both households were able to be supported with one income, whereas most households now, or very many households, require two incomes to support them and to pay the mortgage, to pay the bills, etc. And, you know, long before this referendum took place, we started to talk, God, isn't that a very sort of regressive step in society, in a way that everybody's almost like hamsters in a cage trying to keep a roof over their heads. But the idea is that it values the role that mothers play in the home. Now, it may be outdated. It should value the role that parents play in the home with regard to children. And there should be another proposal with regard to carers, which is a slightly different matter. But that's not what the government have done, as I say. They've lumped it all in together, and it's kind of one proposal, lump it or like it. Sinn Féin say they don't like it, but they're going to they don't like it, but they're going to kind of live with it, because, that's a question that you'll have to put to Sinn Féin, I suppose.
Okay, the other point, of course, is the second part of the referendum, where people are being asked to vote for it in relation to the family aspect of it. So before, up to now, of course, family was founded on marriage. Now we're striking that part out, where the state pledges itself to guard with special care the institution of marriage and to protect it against attack, and removing the words on which the family was founded. They also want to replace our change, amend Article 41.1.1. The state recognised the family whether founded on marriage or on an other durable relationship. Now, this is obviously problematic as well for many people. And Roderick O'Gorman himself was asked to define the word, as many other ministers were, a durable relationship, and everybody comes up with a different answer. But most of all, what he says is it'll be referred to the courts. I mean, we can't just fill up the courts of people claiming to be in durable relationships, can we?
No, we can't. As I say, this is two separate proposals. One might be to you know, there are rights that people enjoy under the Constitution. There's an idea that that the Constitution only protects members of families who are in a married, where the family was founded in a marriage. That's not completely accurate. I mean, people do have individual and collective rights outside
Well,
of
the
that. I
Supreme
mean,
Court
there's
just
a
decided that only last month when
They did in the
they
case of O'Mara, where they found that discrimination between a married family and an unmarried family when it came to the widower's pension was unlawful. This was a case where
His
John
wife had
O'Mara
died,
and his
yes.
late wife didn't marry because she had the family which she was brought up was not a happy family, and she didn't want to repeat that experience. They chose not to marry. I think they kind of decided at the very end, she had a diagnosis of cancer. They decided at the end that they would marry, but it was they didn't get
Didn't
around
get
to it,
time to it,
and the court found that it was unconstitutional based on the fact that all children are equal in the state. I mean, it's a very long time now since sort of the discrimination between one's children that are born to somebody that they're married to, and children that are born out of a relationship that's not a relationship based on marriage, that there was a discrimination allowed. There is no discrimination allowed in terms of inheritance rights, etc. There, any discrimination between children is effectively precluded now by the Constitution, the Children's Rights Amendment, and the finding in
So,
O'Mara bolstered that
what is
finding.
your definition of durable relationship? Because lots of red herrings have been thrown in here, including the truffles, including the fact that culturally somebody could have seven or eight wives, and although we don't recognise the wives as their wives being in married relationships in this country, they could be classed as durable relationships. Also, we've had the suggestion by Neil Richmond, of course, that it could have an impact on immigration because apart from the 12 on average family people from family reunifications, that could be extended now to possibly double that with family reunification. So, it does have a wider impact, this word durable relationship, because really anybody can have a durable relationship.
I mean, it's clear to me that if you're in a stable polygamous marriage outside of Ireland, that is a durable relationship. Now, whether the Irish courts will recognise that as a family, heretofore they haven't said, recognised it as a family. They've said families founded on marriage, and the concept of marriage in Irish law is a monogamous marriage. But that's not to say that it's not a durable relationship. I mean, it clearly is a
Clearly is a
durable
durable relationship, isn't it?
relationship to
With
me, and it's very
numerous
difficult to
people.
see how it won't have repercussions. It's difficult for me to see how it won't have repercussions in family reunification law, but that won't necessarily mean that an entire family can choose to live in Ireland. But family reunification in the context of refugee law or subsidiary protection is where there isn't a choice to live elsewhere. Somebody has left, for example, Syria or Iran or whatever, because they are fleeing indiscriminate violence or they're fleeing persecution. And it is found that they have a justified that their claim is valid and that they need the protection of the Irish state because they can't return to Syria or they can't return to Afghanistan. Well, then that family can't subsist elsewhere. That family, it's not that the family's choosing to live in Ireland, like if it was a sort of a business person or an academic or take your pick who's moving to Ireland. It's somebody who's fleeing persecution. So they have to live in Ireland and they have a right to be joined in their family by their family in Ireland. So how that family will be defined will, of course, have to change if we change what the definition of a family is. Now, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but I think that people have a right to know what we're voting for, and this sort of blithely skating past it and saying, oh, it'll have no impact whatsoever. I mean, if it'll have no impact whatsoever on any law, why is the
Why
government
change it?
proposing it?
Absolutely. I
Yeah,
mean,
I mean,
the
it
other
clearly
problem,
will have an impact
there's quite a
whatsoever.
lot of problems, obviously, in relation to this referendum, including information that was given to the government before the
Well, and
consultation led to
including, I
this.
think, including the way the government went about holding this referendum. I mean, they basically, all stages were committee and report stage, There was no deliberation. There was no let's consider maybe we could break these up into separate questions. We could make it clearer. There was none of that. The government were no, this is what we're going to do. It was an evening in January. We're going to this is what we're going to do. We're going to hold this, and you're going to vote for it. And actually, most of the Dáil did. I mean, those who wanted to call a vote on it didn't even have adequate numbers to call a vote. I mean, I was opposed to the way the wording of it, as were a number of other TDs, but not enough to call a vote on it. So that's where we're at. And I suppose we see all the political parties supporting it, even though as the no vote rises and rises quickly, then we hear more and more concerns about the wording being expressed by some political parties. But that's just
Well,
politics.
including Sinn Féin, by the way, who said they're concerned about the wording but still encouraging people to vote yes. And they said if it's a no vote, they'll rerun it, even though Sinn Féin in the past have said rerunning referendums was undemocratic. Anyway, well, moving on from that, by the way, your own constituents, by the way, which way will you be encouraging them to vote?
Well, I'm voting no. I think
Okay.
it's going to introduce more uncertainty than certainty to the Constitution. And I think uncertainty in law isn't a good thing. So on that
Okay.
basis, I think that I would be encouraging people to vote no.
Okay, moving away from the referendum, two other questions before we finish up today. Michael, you also addressed, your thoughts on the government's immigration policy. Many people have considered it to be reckless, their policy, and the news that 85% of immigrants entering the country are now entering without documentation or not the proper documentation. This was, of course, was revealed on News Talk over the last couple of weeks or so. I mean, that's a very concerning factor. Now, we have seen some cases come before the courts over the last 2 or 3 weeks where people who had entered the country with no documentation are being, either sentenced to go to jail or suspended sentences. I mean, that's a little bit of a turnaround, but mind you, it still means the person is still remaining in the country. So what do you think is happening here? And why do you think we're allowing this to continue to happen, which is essentially illegal?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it is. I mean, what is unique is that it is unlawful to present at the frontiers of the state without a passport, without a valid reason. Now, seems to me to be difficult to explain how you don't have a passport when you arrive at border
Particularly when you
control
got
or
onto a plane
airport,
with one in the
but
first
you did have
place.
a passport getting on a plane.
Yeah.
It's a different matter, though. I mean, if people were sort of coming out of the back of
I get you.
a container in Rosslare or something like that. I mean, people do say, if you're fleeing persecution, you're not going to be hanging around to
Looking
get
through
your
your drawers for your
documents
passport.
in
Yeah.
order. And I do accept that, but it is people who are intentionally destroying their passports. The fact that it is an offence and it's not being prosecuted is unusual. What's even more unusual to me is that the number that arrived, large number arrived in 2022. No prosecutions taken. Very large number arrived in 2023. No prosecutions taken. There was an increasing focus on this. I raised it in the Dáil less than a month ago. I asked, had somebody taken made a decision not to prosecute this? And I was told, oh no, nobody made that decision. And lo and behold, now we're having prosecutions. So I mean, the timing is simply, it's not credible to suggest that the Gardaí just knew about the law now, or the DPP just knew about the law. I mean, clearly, when it became a political issue for the government, now prosecutions are happening, which begs the question: if the government can turn on the prosecutions, well, then they can turn off the prosecutions. And if they
And
didn't
why didn't
turn
they
on the
turn them on
prosecutions,
sooner? Yeah.
well, and if they didn't turn them on,
Yeah.
who did? And who did decide that there wasn't going? Because clearly, somebody decided the law was not going to be followed, and now the law will be followed when it's become a problem for the government. So that
It's a bit
is a
late all the
problem.
same, isn't it? I mean, the
That
horse has
is not to
bolted,
say.
hasn't it?
Sorry?
It's a bit late, really, at this stage because the horse has already bolted with the majority of people coming into the country over the last 2 years anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, just because one is being prosecuted for an offence wouldn't stop a person claiming for asylum in tandem with
No.
that. I mean, you could be a shoplifter and at the same time somebody fleeing for their life. You could
Absolutely.
be somebody who has deliberately destroyed identity documents and at the same time have a valid claim. And I think the two have to be fairly determined and separately determined. But the idea that the government control when laws are pros when people are going to be prosecuted and when people aren't is a very worrying idea with ramifications far beyond.
Do you think it's just optics, Michael? I mean, when we look over the last 3 weeks, for example, we've seen the Minister of Justice talk about deportations and hiring private jets and all sorts of things to deport people. Mm. We've now, obviously, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, people are now being brought before the courts for arriving with no documentation or losing or destroying their documentation. I mean, and the government's saying they're going to get tough on Ukrainian refugees who are abusing the system, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you think this is just good optics now because we're getting close to a general election? And they do know, because according to the Irish Times last week, it's one of the main concerns of the people when they are voting. So do you think it's just optics for the government to now make it look like they're doing something?
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly it's optics. I mean, they added two countries to the so-called safe country list, and South Africa and Botswana. I mean, the number of people coming from Botswana, I think, appears to be tiny, so it is an irrelevance. The big issue is that we have more and more people coming to claim asylum. People do have a right under international law to accommodation while they're claiming international protection, but not thereafter, just while they're claiming international protection. About a third... Certainly over a quarter of the people who are in direct provision are people who have already been determined that they have a right to stay in Ireland. So they have the same right to accommodation as anybody else who's lawfully resident in the state, be it a citizen of Ireland or somebody who's moved here to work from another part of the European Union or whatever, anybody who's lawfully resident. But that's, of course, subject to there being accommodation available. And we know that there are thousands and thousands of homeless in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So they have the same right of accommodation, but no greater right to accommodation. There's also a very large cohort of people. The Minister for Integration, Roderick O'Gorman, told me he didn't know how many. He didn't even know if he could find out. Whose asylum claim has been determined negatively. I mean, they've been told, no, you don't have a valid. You say you're fleeing persecution, or you say you're fleeing indiscriminate violence, but we don't believe you. You don't have a valid claim. But there's a further step in Irish law, humanitarian leave to remain, where the Minister for Justice determines whether she's going to, he or she, is, it's a woman at the moment, determines that you can stay, that you have some overriding humanitarian concern. You might have started a family in Ireland or whatever. I mean,
you've spent a long period of time already here, made your life here, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, but those, there are, people are waiting in excess, far in excess of a year. The number of people waiting is getting greater and greater and greater. She's not making decisions. She's refusing to answer questions as to how many people are waiting, how long they've been waiting. And all of these people are in state-provided accommodation, which there's no right under international law to, as they await this decision of the minister. Meanwhile, she's like throwing her hands in the air and saying, oh, it's awful, the number of people that are coming, when it is within her power to decide.
Do something about it.
Yes, they can stay. And once she says that, yes, they can stay, well, then they can stay, they can work, they can support themselves. Because once you're allowed to stay, you are entitled to the
same rights as any other Irish citizen. Yes.
Yes, including social welfare, PAP, and everything else.
Yeah, so I mean, what you're saying is they have to make their own way.
Some people who are lawfully here are in receipt of unemployment and HAP, etc., and have to support themselves, put a roof over their head with that money. Others are entitled to that and are in direct provision where it is provided by the state. And the Minister for Integration is quite proud of the fact that he doesn't ask people for a contribution for the accommodation and food being provided. So it is a problem of the government's making. I don't think that it's a government that's being particularly kind. I don't think that it's a government that's being particularly unkind. It is clearly, though, a government that is incompetent in how it deals
with. Well, most people have described their immigration policy in general over the last year and a half particularly as being reckless. And that seems to be the case, the thoughts from a lot of people. Absolutely, I think most people believe that, you know, if we can help people in any way, those who properly deserve our help, they should be helped in every way possible and probably helped
even
better.
Well,
and
we also, I think, do have, you know, it is important that people who are fleeing persecution are able to flee persecution. Mm-hmm. I think
absolutely
humanity requires that,
but you can't just have open borders either. I mean, Leo Varadkar has
the majority of the immigration in the world now is economic migration, and
Leo Varadkar has denied we have open borders, but it's hard to kind of look at that and say we don't have open borders because nobody actually gets refused. So realistically, we kind of do at the moment, don't we? I mean, anybody can basically come to Dublin Airport or down to Northern Ireland or whatever way you want to come into Ireland and just claim asylum. If you're not from the European Union, you can just claim asylum. So we do technically have open borders at the moment. No, not de facto, I suppose.
Well, the problem is that people aren't being accepted or refused. They're just being let sit there because the Minister for Justice doesn't want to do her job, which is to make decisions in all these applications for leave to remain, which, and she's not making the decisions.
Finally, just before you go, Michael, at the time during COVID-19, it was a difficult time for all of us, including journalists, including politicians, including everybody. But you were one man who was at the helm, which I greatly admired at the time, by the way, because you were asking the questions that other people weren't asking. And this is, of course, when you were head of the Oireachtas Committee, COVID Committee at the time. Now, I suppose I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, this idea of a COVID inquiry. It has been kicked down the road again. I will hesitate to guess the government are probably not going to want it before a general election. But they did say it's going to be a soft touch thing. In other words, there will be no accountability. It won't be similar to the one in the UK, for example. So there will be nobody accountable for bad decisions. Now, I understand sometimes, you know, in the heat of a moment when data comes in, you might make a decision that's not the right decision. NPHET made many of those that weren't the right decisions. But some of the decisions were disastrous. And they weren't made on data. They weren't made on science. They were just made because we should be doing it like everybody else was doing it. So, I mean, should there be accountability for some of those decisions that were just bad decisions?
Look, I mean, a COVID inquiry, I mean, the big difficulties, where do you end? I mean, do you, you know, or how do you assess whether the decisions made were saved lives, whether they didn't?
Or cost lives.
Whether it was all worthwhile or not. What do you look at in the balance? Do you look at the economy? Do you look at inflation, which obviously inflation rose dramatically in the United States. Here it continued to rise because of the Ukraine war. That was an impact in the United States. I'm hearing still from national school teachers that it had a very profound impact on children, all of that. So I'm slightly skeptical because it's always going to lead to subjective decisions. But one part of it that I think absolutely needs an inquiry with legal powers is looking into what happened in the nursing homes at the very start when the state made decisions around basically discharging all elderly people from acute hospitals into nursing homes. And they were in the acute hospitals where the COVID was in the acute hospitals, and they brought it into the nursing homes and it wreaked havoc. Now, that was a decision that was made by the state or people employed by the state. And the idea that we can get to the bottom of that, because, you know, there are relatives of these people who are looking for justice. They're not alone. Are they saying that the state was reckless with the lives of their relatives because they were old? I mean, we're looking at having a referenda now, and everybody's banding the word discrimination about it. We don't want discrimination against anybody, and that is of course correct. But was there the most basic discrimination? Was there a determination by those in authority that the lives of these people were less worthy of protection or not?
And I did speak to Care Champions about this some time ago, and they believe that the government were reckless in the way they carried out or made that decision at the start.
Well, again, you know, but to be fair to the decision makers at the time, we have to look at what was known about COVID at the time, what they knew or ought to have known at the time, rather than judging them by what we now know. But I mean, it is important that a fair process is put in place for the family members, and to vindicate the right to life of those.
Well, I mean, it was well known, Michael, because I remember at the very start of COVID, when I say the start, after about 2 or 3 months, I remember speaking to Dr. Marcus de Bruin, who you may remember decided to resign at the time. And Marcus talked to us, we were the first radio station he spoke to at the time, you know, about what was happening, about elderly people being moved back into nursing homes, because he was working in nursing homes at the time as a doctor. And at the same time, I remember having Sinn Féin on the air as well, and they seemed quite shocked by this whole thing. So, but there was no doubt, Marcus de Bruin even knew, and many doctors knew, that the most vulnerable to COVID-19, and the majority of those would have the high mortality, would have been those over the age of 75. So we kind of knew at the time, we knew what mortality was like around COVID-19, and yet we kind of still did it.
Yeah, I mean, this was even earlier, though. I mean, some of these decisions were made at the very start of it, soon after, you know, Leo's speech, wasn't it, on the eve of St. Patrick's Day? He made this speech. So it was at that time that that the decision was made to effectively empty the acute hospitals. So I suppose there was some information provided to the COVID committee, certainly not enough for us to look into it in any depth. But I think this is something that will have to be looked into in great depth, because to determine whether or not people died as a result of those decisions and whether those decisions stacked up in terms of what was known at the time. I mean, again, I say that we shouldn't be unfair to people and judge them by what we now know or what we knew 2 or 3 months after the decision, but what was known or what should have been known at the time that the decisions were made. But it is important that this be looked into, and looked into with powers, a committee with powers to compel people. Because, I mean, if we want to, if it's worthy of setting up committees to look into business deals, then I think we should be able to look into decisions that cost large numbers of people their lives.
Listen, thank you very much indeed, Michael McNamara, TD. I appreciate you joining me today, and thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Podcast. Listen live on Facebook, YouTube, and all the usual live stream services. To get in touch, just WhatsApp or text 085-100-2255. The Niall Boylan Podcast. They told me to shut up. Available for download from all your usual platforms.